Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, September 7th. This is the news roundup when we discuss the top local news stories with our colleagues in the print and digital media. With me in the studio, Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Later on in the program, we'll be speaking to Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Let's start with elections this week. Local politics is your beat, so we're lucky to have you with us this Friday. Let's talk about a couple of the bigger races here. The incumbents holding off challengers. We had Congressman Bill Keating won fairly easily.
Yeah, he did. Bill Keating, our congressman here in the 9th District, which actually goes from Norwell over to Fall River and all the Cape and Islands, had a Democrat challenger in the primary. And Bill Keating won easily, 85% to 15%. His challenger was a gentleman named Bill Sombrello from Osterville, who ran as a Democratic Socialist, which is interesting. But, yeah, the race was not as close as a lot of people thought. Bill Keating, in the final days of the campaign, said, "You need to reelect me because I'm part of the group that was really providing oversight to the Trump administration, and we need to keep that going." Whereas Sombrello was saying, "Yeah, you know, Bill Keating represents a status quo, and he's a little too cozy to corporate interests."
So Sombrello didn't pick up any of that sort of larger wave of resistance.
He did not, and of course, incumbents. The big story here in Massachusetts on election night was Ayanna Pressley up in the 7th congressional district knocking off Mike Capuano. And early in the summer, we had Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. And I asked a couple of political scientists this week. You know, we had a couple of progressives here in the Cape. They just didn't get any traction. And he said, "Well, you know, that seems to be working right now in largely urban areas, where the electorate is engaged right now. They're very active, and they like to see their government resemble them in the community a little bit more. So, probably not why they didn't get a lot of traction here."
Let's talk about the Randy Hunt race as well, the 5th district race. In the end, it was not a close contest.
No, not at all. This was incumbent Randy Hunt. He's a Republican state rep from Sandwich, was facing a challenge from Barnstable County Commissioner Ron Beatty, who's known for being quite controversial. Well, not only that he served some time in jail for threatening to kill a couple presidents, one president and Ted Kennedy, but also for some of his provocative takes on issues on Twitter. In the end, Randy Hunt won by about 80% to 20%. It's a bit of a surprise, but his hometown of Sandwich, he really racked up some numbers there, beating Beatty by 1,600 points.
So Beatty,
I'm sorry, votes.
1,600 votes. And Beatty running well to the right. He's kind of modeling himself a lot, or aligning himself, I guess we could say, with the president.
Oh, very much so. And that was one of the interesting things with this race to see in this district. And it was a Republican versus Republican race, was a more moderate pro-Charlie Baker candidate, Randy Hunt. How is he going to fare against the ultra-conservative Trump loyalist Ron Beatty?
And now the Randy Hunt coming up in the next election, and the November 6th race is going to be facing a much younger candidate.
Yes. His name is Jack Stanton. He is the Democratic nominee.
A newcomer, I should
say. He's a newcomer. Yeah. Graduate of Sandwich High School, went to George Washington University, has come back to become more involved in the community, and should be quite a race.
You were, before we went on air, you told me how many days there are until the national election.
Yeah, I believe it's like 59.
59 days until November 6th. Primary turnouts can be kind of quiet when it comes, you know, to these kinds of races, but I guess we saw a bigger turnout than we get typically. You wrote about this for yesterday's paper.
Yeah, it was quite of a surprise. Typically for primaries, especially one, I don't think we've ever had one the day after Labor Day, so that was a big concern for a lot of town clerks, a lot of candidates. 10% is typically the turnout for a primary. And speaking with some town clerks here on the Cape and Islands leading up to the election, one said, you know, we'll be lucky if we get 7%. Well, most every place on the Cape and Islands, with the exception of Nantucket, was approaching 30% or went over 30%. Which was incredible for a primary the day after a holiday.
And what do they attribute this?
Well, I spoke with a couple of folks for this story, a couple of professors, one from Bridgewater State, one from UMass, and they said, well, you know what? The electorate is engaged right now. And he said, especially Democrats, there's a lot of anti-Trump sentiment, so they're getting out there. They didn't really care if it was the day after Labor Day or it was just a primary.
As you look forward, what does that mean for the November election?
Yeah, they said if this continues in November and there's a higher than anticipated turnout, which all indications are it will continue, their take on this is some of the GOP incumbents, we have four of them here on the Cape that are being challenged, could be in a little trouble because the higher vote turnout means primarily the higher number of Democrats are turning out.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're saying this could be a sign that there could be some trouble for some of these Republican candidates.
Let's leave the election now and turn to a long-running legal dispute in Sandwich. A judge has ordered the aerial park there to shut down.
Yeah, this happened last Friday. And this is the Aerial Adventure Park at the Heritage Museum and Gardens in Sandwich. It's been very controversial since it was proposed, actually. I want to say back in 2014. Well, a Superior Court judge here in Barnstable said on Friday, you need to close this down. The building permit should never have been granted. And reason being, there was not sufficiently educational or related educational content there with this particular adventure park related to museum operations to qualify for the zoning protection in the residential area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's something called the Dover Amendment here in Massachusetts. It allows nonprofits with an educational component to skirt local zoning and residential laws. This particular judge said, yeah, you know, you really didn't cut it by putting up a couple signs pointing out flora and fauna on your way to zip lines.
It was interesting. The judge pointed out very specific things, saying that they had kind of tried to dress up the adventure park, in the judge's opinion, to be an educational program. But when the judge examined it, he said it didn't really measure up.
Yeah, they put up some signs to explain some of the laws of physics that might be exhibited on the lines on the bridges between the trees, and once again pointing out some flora and fauna. But then the judge said, he looked at some of the ways they were marketing this. There was a singles night. There was a dress as your favorite superhero night. So he took all that into consideration and said, yeah, this doesn't fit.
And the Adventure Park is actually operated by a company, an outside company, not by Heritage Museums and Gardens.
That's right. This is an outside company, owns 51% of it and operates it. They operate several around the country. And, you know, since this opened, actually, this has been very successful. 35,000 people went to this park in 2017, and they were on target to have 50,000 this year.
Mm.
I don't think we're done with this.
We're going to speak now with Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve. How you doing?
Doing well. Bill, you've got a strong story this week about a seasonal vineyard resident who apparently contracted a disease while on the island and then died after returning home. Tell us what this is about.
Yeah, it's a tough, tough story. Davio Danielson, a seasonal resident of Oak Bluffs, died at Cooley Dickinson Hospital in Northampton, Mass. Last week in an apparent case of tularemia. A little while back, he was working in his yard, brush cutting, and fell ill, went home, and died about 5 days later. The hospital wouldn't confirm that it was tularemia or say much of anything, citing patient confidentiality, but his daughter Maria did talk to us and confirm that that's what the hospital told us, that it was a tularemia incident.
Now, you've done some research along with this about the prevalence of tularemia on the island. I didn't know about this at all.
Yeah, we've talked to Dr. Sam Telford, who's a real expert and comes out here a lot. He's the professor of infectious diseases at Tufts, and there's usually, he said, about 3 to 15 cases a year, you know, not fatalities. The last fatality we had was back in 2000 when David Kurth died. He was a landscaper. And you can get tularemia a couple of ways. It's a tick-borne illness, sort of like Lyme disease, but can be much more serious. But if it's from the tick bite itself, it's usually not as serious. What happens is a pneumonic form of tularemia. That's usually the fatality issue. That happens when people are working in brush or mowing lawns and they run over a rodent, a rabbit often, or a mouse that has tularemia, and the you know, the particles get in the air and they go right straight to the lungs. That is the real, real dangerous tularemia. And, you know, it's not confirmed now if that's what happened this time, but, you know, looks like it.
You're pointing out also the practical steps that people can take to reduce their chances of coming into contact with this.
Yeah, Dr. Telford said, you know, it's not, you know, people shouldn't freak out. It's not Armageddon, he said. But, yeah, you have to be aware, especially this is a tough time of year when a lot of people, you know, leave the island on vacation. People here, the hospital here, they know to look out for Lyme disease and tularemia and things like this because we have had such a high incidence of around here. But when people go home to their hospitals and they have what look like flu symptoms, because it's sort of very similar, you know, you have a cough, you have a fever, you have a swollen gland, and they may just treat it as a cold because they don't know you've been in a high tick incident area. So it's important for people going home if they do feel sick, particularly those swollen glands. That really sort of, you know, tells the tale that your body is fighting something hard. So for people going home, this is really important awareness, just, you know, to be knowledgeable of what it could be.
And tularemia, not necessarily fatal at all if it's caught and treated early. It's been a while since the island saw a fatality.
Exactly. As I said, not since 2000. Yeah, if you get it treated earlier, you get hit with antibiotics, you're fine. There was actually a comment on our story online by a landscaper who said he did contract it earlier this summer and, you know, went into the hospital first. He didn't catch it, but then they did. He said he started actually coughing up some blood, and that was the telltale sign. And he got hit with antibiotics right away, and he's fine now. So if you catch it in time and you get your antibiotics, you know, the cases are usually fine. So that's the real case for being aware. That is the most important thing, that this could be the issue if you do have one of these colds and swollen glands right now.
Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks for that this morning.
Thank you, and I just want to say our heart goes out to the Danielson family. We're thinking of them.
Yes. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Jeff Spillane. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. With us now on the phone is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, the Chatham Fish Pier is a popular spot for folks to see the working waterfront there. An accident this week knocked the observation deck there out of commission. And it also seemed to highlight the continuing concern over safety at the site.
That's exactly right. Monday morning, a forklift struck a support post of the observation deck and forced its closure. Now, repairs were made fairly quickly. It was only closed for a little more than a day, and luckily this happened sort of after the main portion of the holiday weekend was over. But as you said, it highlighted public concerns about public safety down there at the entire facility. You know, the deck, for instance, is already limited to no more than 100 people at a time because of structural issues. And staff who worked down there at the fish pier during the summer said that the limit there was a problem at certain times. They had to sort of ration people coming and going onto the deck. And on some days, they said they counted as many as 4,000 people visiting the fish pier. And they said that this was just completely the busiest summer they've ever seen down there. So it's clear that this is one of the top attractions in town. Some people say it's the top attraction in town. People come to, as you say, watch the working waterfront there, watch the fishermen unload their catches. The seals come in right there at the pier. You know, it's one of the few places where you can actually see a seal just a few feet away from you, because, you know, you're supposed to stay 150 feet away from a seal under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. If they're in the water there, though, it's, you know, that's their fault. Now, the fish market, there's a fish market at the pier, which has grown in popularity, and this has drawn even more people down there. And in order for people to get from the parking area to either the observation deck or the fish market, pedestrians have to walk across a parking lot and an access road that serves the pier, which, you know, it's fishermen stress this is a working commercial facility. There's packing trucks and heavy equipment and other trucks moving back and forth across this access road. And it's possibly a dangerous situation. At a recent meeting of the Aunt Lydia's Cove Committee, Harbormaster Stuart Smith likened all this activity to sort of Disneyland. And committee chairman and commercial fisherman Doug Feeney said he just thinks it's an accident waiting to happen. And this isn't the first time Doug Feeney has raised these concerns. He made a similar remarks to the Board of Selectmen almost exactly a year ago. And there hasn't really been any changes down there. Now, there have been some movement towards making some changes that officials say will make the facility safer, including a walkway, which will channel pedestrians sort of around that access road and parking area. But that implementation of that, it could be a year or two in the future. And meanwhile, a $1 million replacement of the observation deck, which will include an outdoor elevator to meet accessibility codes. That's scheduled to go out to bid later this month, and the work could begin as soon as November, and that's going to basically make the deck unavailable until next spring. So there's a little concern about where people are going to go during the busy weekends, especially over the off season. This past day, Monday, when it was closed, people who wanted to go down and watch the activities there were sort of crowding around the dock where the fishing boats and the Coast Guard have their vessels, and that's not an ideal situation either. So officials are going to have to talk about how they're going to handle the traffic during the time that the observation deck is closed. So we'll be keeping an eye on that and keeping people up to date on what the plans are.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for that.
Thank you, Steve.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. Jeff, story in today's paper, Governor Baker has filed a bail reform bill. Yarmouth Police Chief and the Cape and Islands DA were there for this, and this is really seen as a response to the shooting of Sergeant Gannon earlier this year.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. Just about 5 months ago, though it seems a lot longer now, Sergeant Gannon was shot down in Marston's Mills. And there was outrage after that, given that the person that shot him had such a long criminal record. A lot of people said he shouldn't have been out on the street to do this. Well, on Thursday, Governor Baker filed a bill to reform how bail is granted to repeat offenders. And this would allow indefinite detention of accused criminal career criminals, for lack of a better term, and to hold defendants who are dangerous until trial. Chief Fredrickson of the Yarmouth Police Department said this is a big deal. He called it responsive government, and did come as a result of not only Sergeant Gannon's murder, but there was Sergeant Chesner in Weymouth, as well as the shootings here in Falmouth a few weeks ago.
Now, there are some concerns about the bill. It looked like the ACLU already kind of weighing in with some questions about it. And again, this is just a proposal. It's a bill that governor's filing. It has to go through the State House.
Oh, yeah. It will be debated both the House and Senate once the new session starts. Yeah, the Massachusetts ACLU is saying, you know, hey, you got to think about people who can't post bail, or if you hold them indefinitely, they're going to lose their job. And it says their lives will be upended. So this is going to be an interesting debate coming up in the next few months up on Beacon Hill.
And the governor himself saying that he's looking forward to that debate, that's part of the process here. He's just putting this forward, and now it's up to the state houses to put this together.
Exactly. And a couple other things in this bill, it would eliminate the time limit that someone could be held for dangerousness, which is 120 days. And also require victims of crimes to be notified before any of these defendants are released.
Mm. And it also has a provision for
texting.
The defendants.
Yeah, to remind them they have their court sessions coming up.
And if you decline to text, it says it can actually be used as evidence against you.
Yes.
We'll see where that goes. Taking a look at the next story on our list, another legal contest in the news this week. A pair of resorts in Harwich are responding to a lawsuit filed by the Conservation Law Foundation.
That's right. The Conservation Law Foundation, which is well-known in these parts for filing a lawsuit that resulted in the Section 208 water quality management plan being developed. They filed a lawsuit the end of August against the Wekasidin and Witchmere Beach Club in Harwich. These are right on the ocean. In fact, I was there a couple of weeks ago when the governor was there to talk about water quality at the Wiconset. They claim that they are discharging sewage into the water. But the management of both of these organizations says, you know, we're doing everything by the rule of the law. And they said you should go after the regulators, not the regulated. They say their system's been approved by the Mass DEP. But the Conservation Law Foundation says, well, you know what? You should probably go by the EPA standards, which are much higher and more stringent. And both of the resorts said they offered to meet with the Law Foundation, but they never heard back. So it's going to be interesting to watch this one as well.
And the town of Harwich, it sounds like, is feels like the resorts have been working to comply with this.
That's right. They do. They have all of their permits, and they've done everything that they've been asked to do. And also, it was interesting in the article, I guess Harwich felt slighted a bit because they've already approved $24.8 million for sewering much of that area.
It's been,
so they're moving forward, too.
The town has been moving forward to try to address its sewering issues that
way. Interesting quote by Leo Cocoon as the chairman of the county commissioners. Sometimes you need a push to get to the table, but in this case, we're already at the table.
We're going to speak right now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, former building commissioner has reached a settlement with the town to step down. Tell us about this.
He has. Stephen Butler, who was the former building commissioner and, until he stepped down, a field inspector, was appointed building commissioner back in 2011. He was placed on paid administrative leave last summer while the town investigated his handling of restaurant occupancy issues. He was reinstated this February as a field inspector, a position he held before being commissioner at lower pay, and he and his union filed a grievance over that demotion, and they've been negotiating with the town for a few months now, and reached a settlement, what town manager Libby Gibson describes as a settlement very similar to settlements other employees have reached with the town over employment disputes over the years that regarding demotions or changes in jobs. She and Steve Butler both declined to detail that retirement package at the paper here. We filed a Freedom of Information request for that information as undeniably taxpayer money is going to be used to fund that compensation package, so we believe that the public has a right to know what's in there. This all stems back to this restaurant occupancy issue. It's been an issue on Nantucket for a couple of years now. Town officials have been trying to address overcrowding in some bars and restaurants, in particular on busy holiday weekends and other busy weekends, and they reached out to police, fire, health department, building department to do something about that, and a couple of complaints were filed against Butler by attorneys representing a number of restaurants last year, claiming that or alleging that he was delaying resolution of the matter, which affected their business, and unfairly interpreting some of the occupancy bylaws. That led to his leave while the town investigated. He was reappointed to a lesser position, lower position, last year. None of the details of the investigation were released either at that point. But at this juncture now, he has reached an agreement with the town to step down for what is currently an undisclosed retirement package.
Josh, back to school week for many across the region. What does it look like on the island?
It's a lot quieter. Summer residents, summer visitors have left. The kids are back in school. And one of the issues, enrollment's up a little bit, but one of the main issues, particularly at the middle school, centers around technology, around mobile phones, cell phones, smartphones, and how much students should be using them, when they should be using them. And the middle school this year actually went as far as to prohibit use of smartphones, cell phones in school. Students can bring them, but they have to put them away, and if they're caught with them, they get taken away. Middle school principal Peter Cohen recently gave a presentation at sixth grade orientation where he said it's not just the school's responsibility, it's also the parents. He urged the parents of sixth graders to help the school sort of work with students on their attachment to their cell phones. A lot of parents of school-aged children know they seem to spend more time on their phones these days than they do even in front of the TV. So educators are saying, let's get them concentrating back on school again and out of their phones. At the high school, students are allowed to use their phones in between classes and at lunchtime, and the phones are prohibited in the elementary and intermediate schools, which some people said that sounds kind of silly. That's obvious. But school officials acknowledge that there are students in, as young as in elementary school who are bringing cell phones to school, so they are not allowed to have them, though.
Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for that.
Thank you.
With me is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, we were just speaking about the Conservation Law Foundation lawsuit. Here's another wastewater story. Some people raising questions about how voters can have some oversight of a special commission tasked with kind of envisioning a wastewater partnership between three towns, Dennis, Harwich, and Yarmouth.
That's right. Those three towns are well on their way to forming a partnership, and legislation right now is being crafted. But some concerns were raised in the past week by some of the elected officials in all of these towns. The concern is that in the legislation, there's nothing in there that says the amount of money this commission that has yet to be formed can spend. So there's concern that they may overspend. They can't, you know, they don't have to go for approval to some of the town boards. And that's really raised some concerns here. For those who aren't familiar with it, the plan is for the wastewater from these three towns to be treated in a central facility in South Dennis. It's going to take about 40 years and $1 billion for all of this to happen.
In phases.
And this whole concept is based on a very successful, similar partnership between the towns of Mansfield, Foxborough, and Norton. And Tim Whalen, the state rep there, was working with these organizations and said, well, you know, the legislation is vague on purpose, mm-hmm. so that you can make changes to it without having to go back to the legislature. He says, you know, we'll work on your schedule, but a lot of the people in these towns are saying, let's just move forward with this to get the ball rolling, and then we can add to it as we move along.
I guess the big concern here, again, that towns could be stuck with a price tag, with a big bill that they didn't get a chance to weigh in on.
Exactly. And what they'd like to do is something very similar to what they do at town meeting before major expenditures are made there with this particular commission. They want to have some voter input.
I know the proposed partnership here that they're talking about has gotten a lot of praise from the state mm-hmm. level. It really seems to be taken, at least at the surface, as a solution that we've been looking for wastewater issues for a while.
Oh, and it has. Yep, very much so.
We are going to speak right now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve.
Casey, a popular community benefit event is happening tomorrow in Provincetown. It's the Swim Across the Harbor. I guess this year there's some heightened safety measures being put in place just in case there's an appearance by an unwanted participant. You'd better explain this.
Okay. Well, first, the Swim for Life and Paddler Flotilla is this very Provincetown-esque event that started small 31 years ago and has become this massive event the weekend after Labor Day. What it is a 1.4-mile swim from Long Point, which is the finger of sand that curls back around to face Provincetown, and it goes all the way to the Boat Slip Resort on Commercial Street. And the swim started 31 years ago in the midst of the AIDS epidemic, and it raised money for the Provincetown AIDS Support Group, which is now called the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod. And now over 400 swimmers are expected to show up on Saturday. Last year, the swimmers raised $225,000. And over the past 31 years, the swim has raised $5 million, according to the founder, Jay Critchley, who's an artist and a very interesting and well-known Provincetown character. And over the years, there have been a lot of changes, including the one that we're talking about now, which is the ever more present presence of sharks, which are posing an ever more real threat to the swimmers. There have been two shark bites in recent years in neighboring Truro. So obviously this is on everybody's mind, and the Harbor Master, the Coast Guard, the Cape Cod National Seashore, the Center for Coastal Studies, and volunteers have put together an action plan just in case a shark decides to visit tomorrow. And this incident action plan includes the safety boats making a sweep of the harbor and a couple hours before the swim and right around the swim, I guess, and if they find any sharks in the harbor to the east or the west of the swim area, the event will be delayed for an hour. And if everybody plunges into the water and the safety boats happen to spot a shark, they will sound five continuous blasts, and the swimmers will be directed to evacuation vehicles or the moored vessels in the harbor. There's 75 kayaks and 102 motorized boats volunteering to patrol during the swim, so there'll be a lot of boats out there for people to jump into if that frightening event occurs. People don't seem to be too dissuaded by the threat of the shark. We talked to one guy named Jonathan Scott, who is an avid swimmer, and he calls himself the town mermaid. And he's all set for the swim. He said, if the town mermaid gets eaten by a shark, then we really know we're in trouble.
You do have some numbers, though, about how there has been a significant uptick in shark sightings this year.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, they think that there's a lot of juvenile sharks, perhaps. I think that the numbers have doubled from the prior year, according to Greg Skomal. So there were 149 great whites off Cape Cod in July, which is more than double the 74 observed in July of 2017.
Casey Myers of the Provincetown Banner. Casey, are you swimming tomorrow?
No, but I have done it for several years. It's fun. It takes an hour to 2 hours, depending on how fast a swimmer you are. Actually, the winners usually do it in under 40 minutes.
And then there's a big
took me an hour.
There's a big cookout at the end.
Yeah, the Mermaid Brunch. Yep, that's right, with awards for top fundraisers and top swimming times. It's a huge event, and it's very unique to Provincetown.
Casey Myers of the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff Spillane with me from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, I want to follow up with another shark story here. Mm-hmm. The August 15th shark bite of a man in Truro has raised some questions about the difficulty of communication from some of the outer Cape beaches. And there are plenty of spots there where there's no cell signal.
Yeah, can you imagine how helpless it would feel if you witnessed this and you saw this man lying on the beach and bleeding and you try to call 911, you just couldn't get a call out. That's what happened on August 15th when the 61-year-old from New York was attacked. Some people had to actually go inland about a mile to get the call through. Some people had to run to the town beach, up steep bluffs. There was no service at all. And it was after 4 o'clock, so there were no attendants at the parking lot who have radios and walkie-talkies. Mm-hmm. So Greg Skomal, who we just, Casey just talked about.
He's the state biologist in charge of sharks.
Dr. Shark.
He's Dr. Shark, okay.
He told the Truro Board of Selectmen this week, you need to look at this, because public safety responses are being hampered here, especially on the Outer Cape. And just a little background on what is being done out there right now, the Cape Cod National Seashore Lifeguards, they use satellite phones, and they have some radios and walkie-talkies. The Wellfleet beaches, they use a repeater system, although their director of community service said, this whole thing is making me nervous as we see more and more of these sharks showing up. And one of the Truro selectmen said, maybe we should study a drone program as well to keep a drone up there to see, to warn us in advance for sharks. And one of the most interesting suggestions that I thought came out of this whole process last week is one of the folks from the Truro Select Board said, perhaps we should seriously consider putting a phone booth at the beach.
Old school technology.
Old school technology coming back.
We are going to go to the break now. This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local news stories of the week. And with us from the Cape Cod Times, Jeff Spillane. When we come back from the break, we'll check in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. With us right now on the phone is George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Jeff.
Hey, George.
George, an unusual collaboration is bringing together members of the Coast Guard with the Dukes County Sheriff's Office. Tell us how they're going to be working together.
That's right. So, this is a solution to a problem that the sheriff has been having with staffing the communication center here on the island. The communication center answers all the calls for all the first responders, the fire departments, police departments, and it's a very important role. But he's been having trouble. He only has 7 qualified people right now. He says he needs a minimum of 11 to really do it effectively. And so he was talking about this at a meeting. Coast Guard official happened to be there, and they started talking about how they could work together. And obviously there's a Coast Guard station in Menemsha. The Coast Guard members do not work you know, 24/7. So they would have some ability to take on a part-time gig over at the communication center, earn some extra money, and at the same time help out what's been a nagging problem for Sheriff Robert Ogden here on the island in staffing the communication center. And there are Coast Guard members who are interested. Steve, one of the more interesting things I found in this story, not just that the Coast Guard members would have this time to work part-time, but also that some of the Coast Guard members, because of the high price of real estate and living here on the island, actually commute every day over to the island.
Mm.
So it is an interesting solution to, you know, what's been a problem. They described it as a win-win situation.
You have also an article about an unusual creature native to the vineyard that's opened up quite a field of scientific research. They're here in Woods Hole, too, but I don't know if I've ever seen one of these. Tell us about this.
You know, I know I'd never seen one until I saw the photographs. We have a lot of celebrities on Martha's Vineyard, but this is a celebrity sea slug. And what makes it that is scientists are just, they want to see these, much like people like to see their celebrities out in the wild, so to speak. They're part animal, part plant. And if you look at the picture of them, I know our listeners can't see that right now, but they can go to our website. They look like a leaf floating in the water. And so first discovered or studied by Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole. You know, and it's interesting in the story, there's one of the researchers says when one of his technicians originally came back with the results, you know, showing that this was part animal, part plant, and was using photosynthesis, he said, these results, you know, they're all wrong. You need to go do it again. This is impossible. So I found that very interesting. It's a fascinating read from Bella Bennett, who used to be an intern here, and she studies science herself. Very engaging scientific story. So I don't want people to be scared off by the fact that this is a scientific-related story. Both Bella's writing and also the people she spoke with really put it in layman's terms, you know, that we can all understand, and it's an enjoyable story and quite interesting to see these. As you said, you know, I've been in the water here. I know you have. Never run into them, but I'll be on the lookout now.
For sure. The celebrity sea slug of Martha's Vineyard. George Brennan, thanks for that.
Hey, thanks so much, Steve. Take care. Have a good weekend.
Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. The Mashpee Wampanoag tribe is awaiting a decision by the federal government about keeping its tribal land. This is a big deal not only for the tribe here, but for tribal nations elsewhere. It's a bit dense legally, but a lot of people are watching this.
Yeah, it is. This story's been going on for years, Steve. And 2 weeks from today, on the 21st, the Department of Interior is expected to make a decision whether or not the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe's 320 acres in Mashpee and Taunton will remain in trust. A lot of tribes in Indian country, which is really the reservations here in the United States, are saying they're keeping a close eye on this. One of the reasons being it will give some indication on the Trump administration's position on Indian tribes and reservations, and also whether or not there can be a different translation of what's called the Karcheri versus Salazar decision in 2009, which was actually came out of Rhode Island, which said you tribes cannot be given land or trust if they were not under federal protection as of 1934, which was the Indian Reorganization Act. And so the big question, and this has been going on for years, what does under federal jurisdiction mean? And so I guess one of the arguments that's being made now is, you know, the Mashpee tribe was definitely under jurisdiction of Massachusetts. Would that count?
Yes. And so there's a room for interpretation.
There is room for interpretation. And so a lot of people are wondering, You know, what if 2 weeks from today, the Department of Interior says, you know what, your reservation isn't valid anymore. They're saying, you know, it could be actually transferred to the tribe in what's called a fee simple status, which is the tribe would still own the property. The issue there would, it would be regulated by the towns, it would be regulated by Mashpee and Taunton, and the tribe would be taxed on the property. So they wouldn't be able to really self-govern on that land, which would be an issue. And, of course, another big question here, what does that do to the casino plans that the tribe would have? Mm-hmm. They do have in Taunton for a large casino resort there. And that would really damage those plans. It would really put a hamper those plans.
You have one person in the article quoted as saying they pretty much have to go back to the drawing board on all of those plans.
They would, and they said, you know, perhaps they could, if they really wanted to move forward with the casino, they could make a bid for a commercial license, like MGM has done, and win.
And then they have to compete against other commercial interests there.
Yeah, with deep pockets.
Jeff, the state has raised its fines for people who are poaching fish, and this means catching more than the legal limit or keeping undersized fish. Tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, this is a warning for fishermen out there. Penalties for what are called non-criminal fishing fines are going to double in November. This is part of the environmental bond bill that was passed earlier this year. An example here is someone who's catching an undersized bass. You know, in the past, it's been like getting a speeding ticket. Some fishermen, they deal with it. Others say it's just a cost of doing business. Well, that normally $50 ticket is going to be doubled. Some of these violations could be $100, $200, or $400.
And, you know, and they're going to be charging them per fish.
Per fish, so and that's where
definitely
it really,
rack up as a fine.
Yeah. So if you are caught with undersized bass, and you have dozens of them, you know that's going to add up pretty quickly. One of the reasons that this has happened is because of a lot of issues going on with the Cape Cod Canal.
Mm-hmm.
In August, in 1 week, there were 50 citations issued. And there's a lot of people taking striped bass that aren't ready along the canal.
So fishermen are on notice that those fines are going
they are.
And they're going to be policing them.
Yeah, and that's non-criminal. But if there's a criminal activity involved with your fishing, you could be charged up to $10,000 and 2.5 years in prison. So as the environmental police said, we're bringing these fines out of the Stone Age and into the 21st century.
Now, Jeff, we've talked before on the roundup about the proposal in Sandwich to build a memorial for veterans who served in the Vietnam War era. The project has hit a bit of a snag, it appears.
Yeah, it has. I mean, it was sailing through the approval process in Sandwich. It got through the Board of Selectmen and other boards. Last week, it went in front of the Historical Commission, which said, you know, we have some issues here. I guess 3 out of the 5 members in an informal poll said they were opposed to it. Not that they don't think that there should be a memorial for Vietnam veterans, but the placement of the granite memorial, which would be in Eaton Square, which is right in the center of Sandwich. Mm-hmm. And they're saying there's already too many war monuments there, and there have to be changes to some pedestrian walkways. Well, this didn't sit well with a lot of people. Randy Hunt, state representative, was quite upset, and he had a Facebook post about it. And he's urging people to go to the Historic Commission's next meeting on September 12th. He says, you know, in hindsight, he says, I don't think they really knew how far along this project was and how it had received so many approvals.
And he points to the support in the community for this.
A lot of community support. And once again, it was approved, and even the Community Preservation Commission gave them $15,000 for this. It was post 188 in Sandwich that started this. So they hope to get beyond this next week in the 12th meeting. If all goes well, this memorial will be dedicated in November on Veterans Day.
I want to mention this entangled humpback whale that was freed off of Orleans. Researchers were able to get a rope out of its, cut it loose from a rope. Tell us
about
this. They
did, only a year and a half old, too. But you know what? It's not his first time in the neighborhood. He was here last summer and also had a rope around him. I'm guessing it's a he. And they found him again this past week off of Orleans and Chatham. And he needed to be freed again. He had fishing gear. He was entangled in it. It was actually, he was pulling an orange buoy along with them. So the rescuers did manage to get to him. He wasn't in good shape. He had difficulty eating. And they attached a float to the nets, which kept them above water, so they knew where he was, and took a small boat and were able to cut it away. And he's expected to recover.
Jeff, you've got a nice article about a day coming up that's a chance for some local celebrating of a historical moment. Tell us about this.
Yeah, we might be saying happy Cape Cod Independence Day here on the 27th of September in the years to come. A lot of people didn't know this, and I got to tell you, I didn't either. But on September 27th, 1774, 2 years before the country was declared its independence from Britain, Cape Cod did, Barnstable County. On that day, 1,500 people, if you think about that, back in 1774, I didn't even know 1,500 people were here on the Cape, but they gathered at the courthouse in Barnstable Village to say, hey, you know what, we're not really fans of the punishment that's being given to us for the Boston Tea Party. And by the end of the day, they had a document that declared their independence from Britain. And so this has just come to light, and now they're going to take that document, which unfortunately was burned in a fire in the 1800s. They're going to re-sign a replica of this document to commemorate Barnstable County as being a leader in home rule and kind of ahead of the curve with independence. And it's going to happen on the 27th at a regular meeting of the Barnstable County Board of Regional Commissioners. It's going to be at the old colonial courthouse, and from what I understand, there'll be some period costumes there. There'll be some reenactments, and they hope to do it every year.
And Leo Kakunis, who is the county commissioner head there, saying that he believes this document changed history.
He said he believes it changed history, and he said it's still relevant today. He said because it came out of a protest against tariffs, and here we are talking about tariffs a lot today. But he said, you know, we need to celebrate the fact that Barnstable County was a little ahead of the country on this.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, thank you for being here. And thanks to my other correspondents, we heard from Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We spoke with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.